Resources Committee is now...
Get hit harder.
House Resources Committee is now called to order. Time is 1:00. We have the present, our representatives, Guttenberg, Seaton, Roses, Wilson, Johnson, and myself, Gatto. We have before us two things I want to do today. The first is only going to take 3.1 minutes, and that is I want to pass out one piece of legislation. The other one deals with the TAPS pipeline. So what I want to do right off the bat, we've already had public testimony on the title, of course, is GUI Ducks. We want to pass out the GUI Duck legislation. So Representative Roses?
Yes, as soon as I find it here. Get the number.
You people online, trust us. We will be with you in less than 2 minutes. We just need to move this piece of legislation along, which we've heard previously, and simply want to be sure that it gets its opportunity to advance forward. Do you have it, Paul?
House Bill 26.
HB 26? Was there a CS?
No.
HB 26-8?
Or we did have a
CS for HB.
No. Yeah, I don't have it in front of me.
Fishers. No.
I'll move it. L. You want to move it? Go ahead, move it.
I don't have it.
Oh, version L?
Version L.
Okay, I move that we move House Bill 26, version L.
Are there objections?
And I object.
Representative Guttenberg has an objection.
Thank you. For purposes of discussion, I would just find that I agree with both the sponsor and the department. It'd be wonderful to have an economic opportunity to build another industry. Putting the department and its scientists in a position of having to prove a negative is a concern for me. So with voicing my concern and wondering about the impacts that are unknown on expanding this fishery into areas that haven't had it before, I will withdraw my objection.
Thank you. Are there other objections? Representative Wilson?
Objection, and I would like to make my comments.
I'll give you about 30 seconds.
Well, I too have some reservations. Okay. I mean, you know, there's so much unknown here. We don't know about the sterile GUI ducks, whether what's going to happen, how it's going to affect the area. And so I have some reservations, but I will withdraw my my objection. And but I won't be voting for the bill.
Okay. Are there other objections? Seeing and hearing none. House Bill 26 passes from committee
with attached
physical notes and individual recommendations.
And it was amended, wasn't it?
It is a CS,
as amended,
Mr. Chairman.
It's a CS. Correct. Okay. Correct. Let me correct it all. I'll come back to the correct way to say it. CS for House Bill 26, as amended, with attached physical notes and individual recommendations. Any objections? No objections. The bill passes. We now... Pardon?
It was not amended in this
committee. Okay. Apparently, I hear it was not amended in this committee.
No, not in this committee.
Not in this
committee. So I'm going to move now to the agenda that deals with the... essentially with the report from the initial brief from the commission with from Dennis Melvin, the director of the legal division from Office of Administrative Litigation, and the report is 99 pages. Between those 99 pages is a substantial amount of information. I think this is a great opportunity for us to hear from several people who want to respond to the information inside the report. I'm going to begin with John Katz, who's calling from FERC. He is the Deputy Associate General Counsel for Energy Projects from D.C. John Katz, are you there? John Katz, can you hear me? Okay, I'm going to go to the next person. We'll come back to him. Kate Girard. Can you tell me who is? Okay, John, are you online?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine. You can go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, one moment. Hello?
Yep, go ahead. There's a committee room full of people here who are anxiously awaiting your words.
Okay, this is John Katz, and I should start out by saying that I am not the real John Katz, the Alaska John Katz, but he and I have been burdened with the same name, and occasionally I think get each other's phone calls. And basically, we're here to do what we can to help out the committee. I think that we talked with committee staff early on and explained that because this matter is under litigation in front of the commission, we really can't go into any details about the case. And commission staff's positions, which have been laid out, I think, in the initial brief that I heard you mentioning when we were checking in, are just that, the positions of commission staff and not that of the commission itself. And similarly, anything I say is my own position and not that of the commission or any of the commissioners. But I can certainly start out by telling you procedurally where we are, and I may be able to tell you a very little bit about the background of the case, but I really can't get into any great detail about it. Procedurally, where we are in terms of the commission's processing of this case, all the parties who were interested in doing that filed initial briefs, and that followed a long set of hearings before an administrative law judge here. The parties then can file reply briefs in which they try to rebut each other's positions, and those are due March 21st of this year. The administrative law judge's initial decision is expected in May. Once the judge issues an initial decision, the parties then have 30 days to file what are called briefs on exceptions, which are essentially explaining what they think is wrong with the judge's decision, if anything. And then the parties have 20 days thereafter to file briefs opposing exceptions, so disagreeing with things other parties may have said in their briefs on exceptions. And the matter then is before the commission, and the commission doesn't have a set timetable or statutory deadline for when it needs to act on the administrative law judge's hearing, but it's processed as expeditiously as the commission can. Once the commission issues the decision, that is subject to rehearing before the commission, so parties can file requests for rehearing with the commission if they disagree with what the commission did. For example, the commission may affirm the ALJ, commission may reverse the ALJ, or might affirm and reverse in part. And once parties have filed requests for rehearing, the commission issues an order on rehearing, and the matter then is eligible to go to the United States Court of Appeals. So that's where we are procedurally.
Well, appreciate that. It's pretty helpful to realize that this is not going to, well, I guess with all these things that you mentioned, are we talking the end of the year?
I think it's likely, yes. I mean, as I said, the commission doesn't have a statutory deadline, so a lot of it depends on how complex the matters are raised before the commission, how long it takes the commission staff to prepare a draft order for the commission and for the commission to sort of review it sometimes. There, for those who don't know, there are five commissioners here, and they issue orders acting as a body. It takes a majority. But, for example, if a draft order goes up before them and there's a lot of debate amongst them, it can take them a while to get things sorted out. Or if it's an order that there's not a lot of controversy regarding, they can move things pretty quickly.
Okay.
And I guess what I can tell you basically about the background of the case, and as I said, I can't get into it in a lot of detail, but in 1985, there was a settlement of an ongoing TAPS case, and the commission approved a settlement. And what it does when it approves a settlement is it applies a different standard than if it were acting itself under a statute. So when it looks at a settlement, it looks to see whether the settlement is fair and reasonable. So it kind of takes a high altitude, sort of 50,000 feet look at it. If the commission was determining a rate case, as it is here, under the Interstate Commerce Act, it's required to see whether the rates in question are just and reasonable. And it does that on a cost-based rate process, which is real complex. And what's happened here is the settlement's been in place for a number of years, and then one of the parties, as was their right under the settlement, made a filing suggesting that the rates in question were not just and reasonable and asking the commission to examine those rates and to set cost-based rates. And that's what the commission is in the process of doing in this proceeding. And I guess the one other thing I could say is that commission staff in its brief indicated that the position taken by the state of Alaska in that case was consistent with what commission staff believed to be the correct procedure. So at least on the staff level, there is agreement between the state and commission staff. And I don't know if Kate is there. I know that there's some discussion in the case about the Alaska Commission and its rates and how those relate to the interstate rates, but that's something she probably knows a lot more about than I do.
Okay. Is that concluding your testimony?
yes, unless someone has questions.
It was extremely helpful, especially the way the process has to move forward before any action can be taken. Is there a question from any member on the committee? Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Katz, and thank you for clearing up which John Katz you are.
Sure. Well, as I told him recently, I got three email messages this fall telling me that I'd gotten my absentee ballot and that I should be sure to return it, but unfortunately I had not gotten the ballot, but I trust he did.
Thank you. In 85, the settlement between the state and the producers, or I guess they're called the carriers in this situation. When I've been talking to people, they keep reminding me that if you start taking out bits and pieces, you're missing the whole picture. So the settlement is a larger issue by itself. So in the context of not being able to really look at each little component of the settlement case, is it your opinion at the end that the state got a fair deal on this settlement?
With that I really can't opine on. That's something the state would have to judge for itself.
No, another question.
Go ahead. I'll give you one more follow-up, and then we're going to have to move on.
Okay. Well, I'll just let you.
John, we're going to try and move on. thank you very much. We're going to hear from Kate here, who is going to introduce Carmen Gentile.
Kate? Hi, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm sorry if I was late. I had a hard time getting through on the line. My name is Kate Guyard. I'm the chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And in speaking with your staff, we thought it would be very helpful for you to speak with our FERC counsel that represented us in this matter. I'm happy to introduce to you Carmen Gentile. I do believe he's on the line, and I just would need to confirm that.
Carmen, are you there? Carmen Gentile?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry that I missed a bit. Was there any questions that the members had specifically for the RCA that I wasn't able to
Stay on the line a little bit. I bet we'll have something.
Very well. Then I would like to introduce Carmen Gentile, and Carmen will be providing a brief of as well as the Section 13.4 matter. Carmen?
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Mr. Chairman, basically, we have one objective in the current FERC litigation, and that is the protection of the sovereignty of the state of Alaska over the setting of rates for gas transportation, for oil transportation within its jurisdiction. Our intent, as far as the RCA is concerned, is exclusively dedicated to preserving that authority, which has been conferred upon it by the state of Alaska, to set rates that affect this transportation service and that ultimately affect the costs paid by Alaska consumers. We did not seek out this case. It was a case that was thrust upon us by the TAPS carriers. They, without speculating in detail about motivation, they were obviously upset that the TAPS settlement was being challenged, and they give the impression of attempting to strike out in every direction in order to maintain the settlement arrangement that they have, which they perceive to be to their advantage. The tool that they are using in an effort to encroach upon the state jurisdiction is Section 13.4 of the Interstate Commerce Act. Section 13.4 gives it originated in legislation that was under the jurisdiction of the Interstate Commerce Commission and chiefly applied to railroad traffic. And basically, Section 13.4, in extraordinary circumstances, created an ICC right to override a state regulatory determination. That right could only be exercised in extraordinary circumstances. I would like to emphasize that. Congress was clear, the federal Congress was clear, that they recognized that the state had paramount authority over intrastate rates, and they permitted the federal override only in circumstances of clear-cut discrimination and only in circumstances where the state rates were so low as to create a burden on interstate commerce or to give intrastate shippers an unfair advantage over interstate shippers. The Supreme Court, as it has interpreted Section 13.4, has consistently maintained that state regulatory authority over intrastate rates was to be respected and could be overturned only in circumstances where detailed findings were made to show that discrimination existed or to show that there were unfair advantages conferred on intrastate shippers, are in circumstances where the state rates were so low that they were not making a fair contribution to the carrier's overall costs. The question is, has this Section 13.4 ever been used with respect to oil transportation? I think the answer to that is no, never. It was chiefly aimed at railroads. Whether the Congress really intended this to apply to oil transportation or not is, we think, dubious, and we have pointed this out to the administrative law judge in the brief that we submitted for her consideration. But beyond the question of congressional intent, we also have pointed out to the judge that basically the TAPS carriers have failed to submit any evidence that would support a claim under Section 13.4 to reduce the state rates. And basically, the evidentiary deficiencies were of two kinds. First, they submitted no cost of service evidence. Their evidence was hypothetical evidence based on the TAPS settlement, which uses hypothetical costs. They submitted another technical analysis, two other technical analyses, that were also predicated on hypothetical costs. Basically, we told the commission that unless actual cost of service evidence was submitted, there was no way that the commission could determine that the rates were too low or that the rates were discriminatory. Most participants in the proceeding, including the FERC commission staff, I think all participants in the proceeding, except the TAPS carriers, agreed with the position that we took. We also contended that they had submitted no evidence whatsoever to show any burden whatsoever on interstate commerce.
Mr. Gentile?
I think my
Mr.
first
Gentile?
Point, however, is slightly yep. exaggerated.
Carmen.
They did
Mr.
submit
Mr. Gentile?
Some evidence that
Carmen?
They used to make a claim of interstate burden on interstate commerce. But that evidence was tenuous, inconclusive, and in my view.
Mr. Gentile?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I think you have a substantial amount of information, but we have time limitations. Would you be able to finish your report in five more minutes?
I was about to finish in about two more minutes.
Thanks.
I'm not giving you a short shrift.
Take the whole five.
Okay. Basically, what we have done in the hearing is to make these contentions. Basically, again, defending the sovereignty of the Alaska process and the integrity of the commission of the RCA's rate making process in its order 151. I will mention one specific issue which is of particular importance, and that is to say that the carriers through the TAP settlement over a period of many years collected accelerated depreciation. They took depreciation at a very fast rate. Now, in rate making, the more depreciation you take, the smaller your investment base is, because the depreciation is subtracted, the accumulated depreciation is subtracted from the rate base. The carriers ask not to recognize this historical actual depreciation. Essentially, what it does is it puts them in a position of seeking a double recovery. We have not made any contentions regarding the interstate rates, but we have pointed out to the FERC that in considering the intrastate rates, the Alaska Commission was appropriately took into account these depreciation recoveries. In the case, the matter is now submitted to the administrative law judge, at least in terms of the initial brief. We will submit reply briefs on the 21st of March. As I indicated, most of the parties in the case, all the parties in the case, with the exception of the carriers, support the state of Alaska's position. We believe that the administrative law judge was sensitive to our views based on her behavior and comments during the hearing, and we are optimistic that she will write a favorable decision, which will then, of course, be appealed to the FERC Commission as a whole. Ultimately, this case will probably go to the courts for final resolution. But we believe that we are taking the correct position, and our position is well documented and well supported. That completes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Gentile. I do have one question from myself. If indeed the decision was made and the producers would have to charge a lower rate to the complainants, how would that affect the rates that the state is paying?
I'm not sure I understand. Do you mean the rate that is being paid for intrastate service?
Carmen.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Mr. Chairman, if I may interject, I think that that's probably a question that is going to be answered by the presentation of Anadarko Tesoro, and so the RCA wouldn't have a position on what the impact is between interstate rate and the rate that the RCA has deemed just and reasonable.
Okay. Thank you, Kate. That helps us to stay on track. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. Could you expand on what you mean by double recovery on depreciation?
Mr. Chairman, the issues, again, are better presented by Anadarko Tesoro. That is a component of the interstate case, and I do believe that they are going to present on that matter as well. We do not wish to avoid your question, but I have looked at the presentations that are going to come forward, and I think that you will have a very good one from the other parties.
Thank you. Being just a regular taxpayer, I think the difference between accelerated depreciation and straight line depreciation is the question that will be answered.
Very well.
We appreciate that. Is Stephen Bros online?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Stephen, I need you to identify yourself and your affiliation.
Okay.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Yes, my name is Stephen Bros. I'm with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson, and I'm one of the counsel of record for the TAP's owners in the FERC proceeding. And I do appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing, particularly being permitted to do so by telephone.
And you're teleconferencing from D.C.?
That's correct.
And We have as much as 15 minutes. Anything less would be an advantage because there are about six people behind you, and we do have the time limitation. So go ahead.
I'm certain I will take much less than that. And let me first say that I'm not appearing here today to discuss the merits of the issues in the FERC case or to argue in favor of the TAPS owners' positions in the case. The owners have submitted a detailed legal brief that defends the rates at issue in the case as lawful under the governing standards and in compliance with the TAPS settlement agreement, and we think it is appropriate to let the FERC decision makers rule on the issues based on the arguments in that brief and those filed by the other parties. What my comments will focus on is the procedural status of the case and how it can be expected to unfold going forward. And I recognize you've heard some of this already today, but I would appreciate your indulgence while I say it from our perspective and in some sense reinforce some of what you've heard. And let me first put into context the FERC proceeding that is the subject of this hearing. That case relates to the TAPS interstate tariff rates, and by that, of course, I mean the rates for service on TAPS for barrels that travel the full distance to Valdez and then are loaded onto tankers for transportation to destinations outside the state of Alaska. And the interstate rates at issue in the FERC case are for the years beginning 2005. The TAPS intrastate tariff rates, and by that, of course, I mean the rates for service to destinations within the state of Alaska, apply to a relatively small fraction of the total TAPS volumes, and those rates were the subject of the separate proceeding before the RCA. And as you've heard, the RCA did order a rate reduction that has resulted in intrastate late rates lower than the interstate rates that are at issue in the FERC case, but it should be kept in mind that the RCA decision is still subject to active litigation and is currently under consideration by the Alaska Supreme Court. Now, the TAPS owners are defending in the FERC proceeding the interstate tariff rates that each of the owners filed with the FERC in compliance with the agreed-upon rate methodology that's provided for in the TAPS interstate settlement agreement, which Mr. Katz briefly addressed earlier. Now, the TAPS interstate settlement agreement is a binding long-term contract that was entered into in 1985 by the state of Alaska and the TAPS owners to settle what was at that time a very lengthy, expensive, and complex litigation regarding the TAPS tariffs. And like any settlement, the terms of the TAPS interstate settlement agreement represented compromises on both sides. And the agreement was presented to the FERC, and it was approved by the FERC, and then subsequently was approved by a federal court of appeals in 1985 and 1986. And what it has done is set a ceiling on TAPS rates since that time. The agreement could terminate as early as the end of 2008 if a new agreement is not reached by the TAPS owners and the state of Alaska in the interim. Now, Tesoro, which was a TAPS shipper at the time, was not a participant in the interstate settlement. And Anadarko, in contrast, has never been a TAPS shipper, and it did not produce its first barrel in Alaska that was shipped by others through TAPS until some 15 or so years after the settlement agreement was executed. Now, the principal issue in the FERC case is whether the TAPS interstate rates since 2005 satisfy the Interstate Commerce Act requirement that they be, and that you've heard the term already today, just and reasonable. And the just and reasonable rate standard is intended to assure that the pipeline rates are fair both to ratepayers, and by that I mean the shippers who are the direct customers of the pipeline, as well as to the pipeline's investors. Now, the case was tried over a period of about 2.5 months before an administrative law judge, the Honorable Carmen Cintrone. The record presented to Judge Cintrone includes the written testimony of some 35 witnesses, the majority of which were sponsored by the TAPS owners, and the record totaled nearly 7,000 pages of transcript with more than 800 exhibits. And as Mr. Katz mentioned, briefs were filed about 2 weeks ago by seven separate participants, and reply briefs are due to be submitted on March 21st. Judge Cintrone is then scheduled to issue her recommended decision by May 18th. And at that point, participants can, as you heard, take exception to the judge's opinion in briefs that will be filed to the five FERC commissioners. And it's the decision of those commissioners, those five people, that will reflect the position of the FERC itself. And that FERC decision, in turn, we certainly agree, can be expected to be appealed to a federal appeals court by one side or the other. Now, we're certainly aware that the announcement setting this hearing made special mention of the brief of the FERC trial staff, and we think it's important to understand that in reaching their substantive decisions in the case, neither Judge Cintrone nor the FERC commissioners, much less a federal court of appeals, are bound to adopt or even to give special consideration to the position of the FERC trial staff, and it can't be presumed that the judge or the commissioners agree with the staff's view. And history shows many times when the FERC trial staff position has not been adopted by either the hearing judge or the commissioners. In the TAPS case, the FERC trial staff's brief presents the views of a single participant in a large and complex proceeding. The trial staff often sponsors witnesses and cross-examines the witnesses of other parties in a case, but in this case, it elected to do neither of those things. Six other briefs, which offer widely varying positions on the many issues in the case, were submitted at the same time as the staff's brief, and again, responsive briefs by all participants are due to be submitted on March 21st. And significantly, under the FERC's rules, the trial staff is not permitted to communicate about the case with the decision makers other than through briefs and other on-the-record submissions. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are several widely differing positions and arguments that have been put forth in the pending proceeding on literally all of the matters that are in controversy. The case presents a large number of complex legal issues involving matters of contract and statutory interpretation, as well as regulatory policy, and we believe those issues are properly entrusted to the current process before the FERC for resolution. But keep in mind, the case is not at all one-sided. The TAPS owners are vigorously defending the lawfulness of their rates and opposing the positions that have been presented against them in virtually every respect. And if you wish, we would be happy to supply you with the other briefs that have been filed in the case, including not only those of the TAPS owners, but those of in-state refiners other than Tesoro. Now, in summary, let me just say that the TAPS owners wish to emphasize the procedural status of the case as it stands today. There's been a range of views presented to the administrative law judge in the form of initial briefs, none of which, including that of the FERC trial staff, is entitled to any special deference. The case is in the very early stages of its decision-making process. Not even the initial recommended opinion by the administrative law judge has yet been issued, and an ultimate decision will not be announced until sometime, maybe quite some time in the future, and perhaps not even until after expiration of the settlement agreement itself. The staff brief and the positions of Anadarko and Tesoro that you've heard about today are not determinative of any outcome, and we believe it's premature to even speculate on the precise outcome of the case before a final resolution is reached. And I thank you again for the opportunity to participate in this hearing.
Don't go away. There may be some questions. But just for the record, we've been joined with much earlier with Senator Dyson, Representative Faircloth, Senator Terrio, and Senator Stevens. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Terrio has a question for you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your caution that we should not jump to the conclusion that the brief by the FERC staff is binding at all. I understand that, and actually appreciate the comments on the length of the process and how it will play out. But I think what struck me is, number one, the fairly strong language, as I read it, that is used in the brief. And I think, you know, for myself, I do take something from the fact that the individual that wrote this is, number one, in, you know, it's their job to try and understand these issues. And they don't, for lack of a better term, have a dog in the fight, really, except for the fact that the agency itself might be looking to or making an argument for the preservation of the precedent that they have set in the past. Do you have any comments to that? And then also, how about the comment, and I was flipping through here looking for a quick quote where he uses terminology along the lines of, to agree with that particular opinion would abrogate, you know, decades of FERC precedent. And so I'm just wondering if you have any kind of response to use of language like that and the fact that this individual is not representing a company that is, you know, going to pay a price or win the fight necessarily if there's a particular outcome.
Yeah, my comments have to be limited for a number of reasons. Let me first say that we will be responding quite vigorously to the FERC trial staff's brief on March 21st, and we anticipate pointing out many instances in which the staff's brief itself is inconsistent with settled commission policy. I'm certainly not going to speculate on the motivations of the trial staff or of any individual. I will recall, however, that the staff was not one of the supporters of the TAP settlement agreement at the time, and to the extent to which that may be affecting positions today, I really would prefer not to speculate.
There's a follow-up question.
Thank you. And your statement about is it Mr. Melvin in particular that you say was not supportive at the time, and that I wasn't sure exactly how long he had worked at FERC. Of course, on the front page of the document, it says Dennis Melvin, legal director of the legal division, so that led me to believe that perhaps he had been there for quite some time. Can you shed a little bit of light on exactly how long he's been around, and can we infer anything as far as his level of expertise in evaluating this type of stuff?
Yeah, Mr. Melvin has been at the commission for quite some time. He and I were both, I'm not sure if I'm proud or chagrined to say we both were there in the original case that ended up in the TAP settlement agreement in 1985.
Thank you.
And you said that he was in disagreement with the settlement?
I did not mean to personalize that. The FERC staff was in disagreement.
And when you say in disagreement, you mean 5-0, 3-2, or are we talking the commissioners or just conversations among the staff?
No, the commissioners themselves approved the settlement agreement. There were stages along the way where there were briefs submitted to the commission, and I apologize. I'm actually speaking from recollection here, and if I am to be corrected, I will certainly stand corrected. My recollection is that that the staff was not among the parties that were actively supporting the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement was supported by the TAPS carriers and by the state of Alaska and the United States Department of Justice.
Am I correct when I say that the FERC, once they have an agreement among the parties, that they essentially step back and do not object? Or do they have to actually agree with both parties that this is a just and fair settlement?
Well, I think we have to distinguish again between the staff and the commissioners. The commissioners certainly do not have to accept a settlement agreement among the parties. There have been a number of instances over the years when they have rejected settlements among the parties. In this instance, they did accept it. Now, the FERC staff, as a participant in the case, is entitled to present whatever views to the commission it wants with respect to whether the agreement ought to or ought not to be accepted.
Okay. Other questions? There's another question from Senator Terrio.
But just to clarify, that acceptance was not an admission by the commissioners themselves that the underlying settlement would hold up to scrutiny under FERC rules on whether the resulting tariff was just and reasonable.
That is correct. It was accepted as as what was called an uncontested settlement, as fair and reasonable and in the public interest, as opposed to just and reasonable. That is correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thanks, Mr. Bros. If you would like, stay online because there's probably six or so other people that will be testifying, and you you might want to know exactly what their thoughts are. Next, we're going to go to Phil Reeves, Alaska Department of Law. And he is present here and will take the chair, but I still need you to, on the record, introduce yourself and the affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Philip Reeves, Assistant Attorney General in the Oil, Gas, and Mining Section, and I'm the Department of Law's manager of the case for the state's position. Coming this far along in the hearing, you've already heard an awful lot of the notes that I had here, so I think that I'll simply focus on the differences between the state's position and what the state's position is in this case compared to some of the other positions that have been stated here today. And I, once, as many of the other testifiers have stated, I will not go into a great deal of detail about the state's position because we are in the midst of the briefing period and so we're deep in the heart of the litigation. The current FERC litigation consolidates state protests of the 2005 and 2006 TAPS rates on the grounds of unjust discrimination and undue prejudice, and protests of Anadarko and Tesoro that the rates are not just and reasonable. So the state's protests here are on substantially different legal grounds than the protests of Anadarko and Tesoro. Anadarko and Tesoro, I understand, will be here to testify, so they'll present their position. The state's protest is grounded in the TAP settlement agreement. The settlement agreement expressly provides that, notwithstanding any other provisions of the agreement, rates charged are subject to legal prohibitions on unjust discrimination and undue prejudice. The state's protest, therefore, is actually seeking to enforce a specific term of the settlement agreement. One of the main reasons that we are on such a different legal path than Anadarko and Tesoro is Anadarko and Tesoro are not parties to the settlement agreement. Insofar as rates are filed in conformance with the settlement agreement, the state, as a party to that agreement, will not protest them. But as I've said, here we have an express term that is actually included in the TAP settlement methodology, the methodology by which the annual rates are calculated. This is the final term of the methodology, and it says, notwithstanding any other term, the rates charged cannot violate legal prohibitions on unjust discrimination and undue prejudice. Those legal prohibitions are found in the Interstate Commerce Act, and it's under the Interstate Commerce Act that oil pipelines are regulated. The state is not here requesting a specific amount of dollar damages. It's simply requesting a correction of the unjust discrimination and undue prejudice in accord with ICA sections 2 and 3. We seek to have the interstate rates lowered to a level at or near the intrastate rates to within a zone of reasonableness determined by the commission, based on the fact that the TAPS carriers are charging substantially divergent rates for essentially the same service, the service of shipping oil from Pump Station 1 on the North Slope to Valdez. I know that there were questions regarding calculations of what could possible refunds be, what could the dollar amount in issue in this case be. The calculation of the total amount of potential refunds is subject to a lot of variables. Annual throughput, the amount of the rate reduction that might be ordered for each year of the protest, the percentage of the state's interest through royalties and production taxes in the oil. I understand that you've requested the Department of Revenue to testify today, and I have spoken with them. They've run a calculation, and from a professional economist perspective, that is illustrative of what might be the high end of some refunds. But at this point in time, the state's brief isn't asking particular dollar amounts. We're seeking to correct this legal prohibition on unjust discrimination.
Interrupt you for just a second. Are you suggesting then that were a settlement to be made that would be approved by all parties, that the state would not ask for refunds from any past excess charges?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand your question. Certainly the state isn't taking any position that it would not seek its share of refunds.
Okay.
If I
misunderstood you then. I thought the state was simply interested in solely getting an agreement made that everyone, all parties, would be willing to sign on to and then proceed forward from that point with no regard to past charges.
I'm sorry, perhaps I wasn't clear. Under the TAPS settlement agreement, the TAPS carriers file new rates annually. And so under the procedure, once a rate is filed, it may be protested within 30 days. The settlement agreement, I believe, gives us 15 days to protest. We protested the 2005 rates when they were filed in 2004 based on the fact that the intrastate rates for shipments were $1.96 under the RCA determination, and the carrier's average charge was approximately $4 a barrel. The rates filed for 2006 and 2007 for interstate shipments are higher than the 2005 rates, and so we have followed up our protests of the 2005 rates with protests of 2006 and 2007.
But the RCA rates have stayed consistent or steady.
The rates being charged.
It's just the interstate rate that has risen.
The rates being charged, yes, have remained at the level set by the RCA in Order 151. I'm not sure that was actually the order that imposed the rates, but it determined the just and reasonable level of rates for the intrastate shipments. And as Mr. Bros stated, that RCA decision order is still subject to legal proceedings. It is at the Alaska Supreme Court at this time.
Senator Terrio has a question.
Just with regard to the statement that the state is not seeking any kind of refund or anything at this point, but if the challenging parties Anadarko and Tesoro are successful, that in getting a lower tariff, that works back through the taxation system and the royalty valuation system, and funds would accrue to the state treasury as a result of them being successful.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio. That's correct. Actually, the state is not a shipper on the pipeline. Where the tariffs come into play in calculation of a state financial interest are determination of the wellhead value of the oil. Of course, under our leases, we can take the royalty and value at the wellhead, but then we have to know what the value is at the wellhead, and most of the oil is sold on the West Coast. So there's a formula that's called a netback calculation that allows deduction of tankerage and tariff costs. So if you drop the, if the interstate tariff were to be reduced to by approximately $2 to the level of the interstate tariff, then that would relate back to the determination of the wellhead value, and the state would have additional funds coming.
Thank you.
I had quite a bit of information on the process, but you've heard it about four times, so.
Okay. Stay right there. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing no questions, I certainly.
Mr. Chairman,
sorry,
actually,
Senator Terrio.
Just it's such a strange dynamic with regards to the unjust discrimination. The unjust discrimination, the state was only able to make that claim because Anadarko and Tesoro went to the RCA to get the intrastate rate lowered. And therefore, did that give the state the opportunity then to make the claim that the formula was being applied on, you know, improperly because now there was this disparity between intra and interstate?
It's certainly a fact that, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Terrio, it's certainly the fact that the intrastate rate is widely divergent from the interstate rate that brings us into this express provision of the settlement agreement that denies the charging of discriminatory rates.
Okay, and so in being partners with the companies initially on the settlement methodology, sort of bound our hands. Even if we thought there should be a lower tariff, mm-hmm. we were bound by the terms, and it wasn't until somebody else protected their rights that gave us sort of that platform to build our case on.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, our case is definitely founded in the settlement agreement itself in the non-discrimination provision. Before the time that the RCA reduced the level of the intrastate rates, they were calculated under a settlement agreement that's virtually identical to the interstate settlement agreement. So the rates were always nearly identical. There was no discrimination. There were no grounds for a protest such as the state has levied now.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Just curious, if indeed the producers were to overwhelmingly win their point of view, would the RCA be required under any conditions to raise their rate up to the level of what the methodology would require from the producers?
Mr. Chairman, the TAPS carriers have argued in response to the state's discrimination claim and to Anadarko Tesoro's claim that it is the intrastate rates that are set at an inappropriate level. They cite to Section 13.4 of the Interstate Commerce Act, which does give authority in certain circumstances for the FERC to order an increase in the intrastate rates. However, the burden for that is much greater than the burden to lower the interstate rates under Section 2 or Section 3 of the Interstate Commerce Act. It requires a showing that the intrastate rates do not cover a fair share of their costs. And so that's a burden that the carriers were required to meet, are required to meet in this process in order to prevail, whereas failure to show that leaves you with Sections 2 and Sections 3, which simply look at is the difference in rates outside of a zone of reasonableness and allows only for the remedy of lowering the interstate rate.
Often in the States, it's a situation where you have a company with shareholders, and so the regulatory commission tries to defend the shareholders in that ensuring that all of the costs are recovered. With regard to the RCA, my understanding would be they've already evaluated that the costs are recovered and therefore have set that rate at $2.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I can speak intelligently about these issues, but we're definitely getting deep into the individual specific issues of the case, and we don't feel it's appropriate to get into that level of detail at this point in the litigation. So I'm sorry.
No, understand. Thank you very much for your test. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Terrio has a question.
One of the things that is some of the verbiage that jumps out from the staff report is with regards to costs. There's a lot of statements that the companies did not provide adequate data or provide any data at all as to whether the costs are just and reasonable. I think they use that terminology. They just want to look at historic costs that were allowed under the settlement itself. So in the company's claim that in fact the RCA rate should be raised, will they have to provide actual cost data to show that the rate, in order to be just and reasonable, should be raised?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, I suspect that the attorney for Anadarko Tesoro may be willing to speak more about this with you. The just and reasonable claim is an Anadarko Tesoro claim versus the non-discrimination claim of the state of Alaska, and I really hesitate to get involved in that level of detail in the case.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate your testimony. And next, we're going to hear from the person, actually from Anadarko, Mark Hanley. Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Very clearly. Go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation, and then proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Hanley. I'm the public affairs manager for Anadarko here in Alaska. And we're going to have three of us in our 15 minutes, and I'll be brief, as will Kip, I believe, and then we'll turn it over to our attorney. I had your staff hand out a copy of the press release that the RCA did on their decision on November 27th, 2002, because that's what opened our eyes as an interstate, or as to the rates in the state, when they claimed that there was $10 billion in excess collections and rates that were 57% too high. So we started looking at this issue. Many of you may know, but you may not, that we're a 22% owner at Alpine. So we have around 22,000 barrels a day of production, about 8 million barrels a year of production. So when you start talking about things, as you've heard discussed, where the intrastate rate now has been set at about $2, $1.96, and the interstate rates are actually for 2007 over $5 a barrel, we're talking about, you know, $3 a barrel on our 8 million barrels a year is a fairly significant amount of money. Obviously, the state, I think, the state's value is much higher than that, but it got us interested, and it took us about 2 years, and we finally filed the case in November of 2004 on the interstate rates. Again, I think it bears repeating, it's a significant dollar amount to us. It does affect exploration economics when we run our economics for the fields that we are trying to explore, and that's not just us, it's all new players on the state. $3 a barrel or $2 a barrel, even a dollar, is pretty significant. So I would just say that that's why we filed the case. Obviously, we're quite happy, as I think was raised in one of the questions. We all have our own opinions and sides, but to have FERC staff come out and support our position is actually very, we're just happy to have that happen. Obviously, the judge and the FERC commission will have to make their own decisions, but we're happy to be where we are at this point, and I'll turn it over to Kip to talk about Tesoro.
Hold on. Any questions for Mr. Hanley? There are no questions. You're off the hook. Kip is taking over.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kip Knutson. I'm External Affairs Manager for Tesoro Alaska. Tesoro Alaska is a value-added success story in our state. For 38 years, we've been manufacturing fuels for Alaskans with Alaska's resources. In fact, in 1977, Tesoro had the honor of being the first Alaska refinery to purchase crude shipped on TAPS. Today, we purchase roughly 30,000 barrels out of the North Slope. We buy every drop that's produced in Cook Inlet, roughly 17,000, and we're in the odd position of being an Alaska refinery in this huge resource-rich state, having to import oil to fill our refinery with crude. So one of the reasons that we're in this case is we think that the economics need to be improved so that we can have an opportunity to buy more crude off of the North Slope. There's a couple of points that I'll just mention that are in the brief that are important to Tesoro. First, that the methodology agreed to by the TAPS owners, this is the TSM, in no way precludes a party that was not signatory to that settlement in seeking a just and reasonable rate through the regulatory process. The second point, and it was also recognized in the brief, is that the TSM methodology does not achieve or does not tease out this just and reasonable rate. Tesoro's objective is simple. Just and reasonable rates should be in effect for TAPS using the standard and accepted principles of rate making well known at both the federal and state regulatory levels. We believe that just and reasonable rates will have a significant benefit to the state, to the Treasury, and have the added benefit of increasing exploration and development of marginal fields on the slope. And with that, I'll thank you very much for your time and turn it over to Mr. Brenna.
I'm going to ask a question, though, before we go over. It's something that appears throughout the report, and that is if the producer owns the pipeline, then it almost doesn't matter how much the tariff is because they are essentially paying themselves. Does the state become a loser as the tariff goes higher and higher when they're simply, the producers are simply paying themselves? And if so, I need you to, if someone, and if not you, then Mark, and if not Mark, then your attorney, to elaborate on how the state becomes a loser with the high tariffs.
Well, the higher the costs associated with producing and shipping the oil, the lower the net back value is at the wellhead, and your taxation policy is based on that wellhead value.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio?
In addition, I think there's the intangible that Mr. Hanley touched on, that the higher the transportation costs, the larger the fields have to be for somebody to afford to be able to put them into production and ship. And of course, for the smaller players that are not owners of the line, that shipping cost is lost to another entity, and that being the pipeline company. And of course, there are, as you mentioned, there are some companies that are just paying themselves from one pocket to another. So we've got not only the potential impact to the Treasury with regards to the increased transportation cost and how that impacts the wellhead value, which our taxation system and royalty system is based on, but you've also got the potential chilling effect on some exploration and development activities that play there too. So, and also, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to take this while Mr. Knutson is here to just disclose that I own a small percentage, or $5,000 of Tesoro stock. So, just to put that on the record.
Well, then, donuts. thanks, Mr. Knutson. We're going to go over now to Robin Brenna. And Robin, you have can you hear me, by the way?
Yes, sir, I can.
Thank you. We have a handout, Brenna, Bell, and Clarkson, PC, presentation to House Resources Committee. Will you be working off of that presentation or not?
I will be referring to it, yes.
Thank you. We're actually ahead of schedule, so go ahead and start your presentation, and first off, your name and affiliation.
My name is Robin Brenna, and I'm an attorney with Brenna, Bell, and Clarkson. And I am the attorney. I represented Tesoro in the proceeding before the RCA that lowered the state rate from basically $4 to $2. And I am the attorney representing Anadarko and Tesoro that's requesting that the FERC also establish just and reasonable rates and lower the rates from what are now $5 to $2. Just in terms of my background, A couple things. First, the federal proceeding is about just and reasonable rates, and I want to explain what that means in rate-making terms. What it means is that a carrier has an opportunity to recover its cost of operating the pipeline. It has an opportunity to recover its original investment, and it has an opportunity to recover a reasonable return on the investment that it has not yet recovered. And I will refer to that as just and reasonable rates or cost-based rates. And the basic thought is that what you charge somebody is based on the cost of providing service to them, and that is the basic concept behind just and reasonable rates. It wasn't until the RCA established a $1.96 rate. That was the first just and reasonable rate established on TAPS in its 30 years of operation, and essentially cut the rate in half. I won't beat around the bush about this. The TAPS rates have gone from $3 on an average roughly in 2004 to $5 on average in 2007. The state rate has been $1.96 that I'll just loosely refer to as $2. And $2 is a right rate, and the amount that they're collecting over that is excess return. The carriers are making essentially 100% return on their equity each year that they operate TAPS. And with regard to the FERC staff's position, Mr. Melvin is in charge of the litigation staff attorneys. He has 16 attorneys that report to him. He's been involved in these matters for a very long time at FERC. His opinion matters. But I agree with the comments made about where this process is. But I'd like to point out that through going through the state proceeding and the federal proceeding, every objective third party that's had an opportunity to take a look at these issues has said that the right rate on TAPS is about $2. And by that, I mean that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska said it should be about $2. The Superior Court of Alaska affirmed the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in every respect. The RCA staff took the position that it should be about $2, who is also an objective third party, and has now the FERC staff. So it isn't, I agree with Mr. Gross's observation that they're litigating feverishly. On the state proceeding, they spent over $20 million opposed to just having reasonable economic regulation established on TAPS, and and the FERC case is a large case, too. So far, on this particular matter, there's probably been about 80,000 pages of record established, and
could we have copies of that?
I'd be happy to give a copy to each member of the committee. just one procedural matter. We did send down to Mr. Rice. We did send down a copy of all the parties' briefs in the email, so that he can just jump site to those and copy all of the initial briefs of all the parties for those of you that are interested in that. So let me just, given that background, let me turn a little bit to the 85 settlement. The 85 settlement did not establish just and reasonable rates and didn't purport to, and gave future shippers the right to ask for them. And so essentially we have. The methodology contained in the 85 settlement, which is the TAP settlement methodology, or the TSM, doesn't work to set cost-based rates. And it isn't even close. I mentioned the excessive returns. They have an allowance per barrel that's $1.19 that they just charge on for throughput that has nothing to do with costs. Under the TSM, they're allowed to make up whatever rate they want based on their own subjective projections of costs and throughput, and in fact, their rates vary amongst themselves even though their costs are the same. And the depreciation under the TSM is based on the wrong economic life. They're assuming the end of the life of TAPS is 2011, when it's commonly accepted that it's well beyond 2034. So the TSM doesn't work, never worked, was a bad deal for the state, and resulted in rates that are twice what they ought to be. If you go to page 4 of the handout that I get, it's TAPS, an example of not getting transportation rate rights. I just put it in global numbers. The TAPS carriers through 2004 have collected $60 billion, and I round it to the nearest billion, They have invested 10 and spent 15 billion operating the line. So they've got 25 billion into building it and operating it, and they've gotten 60 back from any standard of any business standard of looking at it. That's excessive. When you compare the 35 billion in return in taxes that they've gotten compared to traditional rate making cost based just and reasonable rates, they are either 18 to they're either 14 or 18 billion depending on what approach you adopt. There are billions and billions over collected. That is what the RCA held. That is what the FERC staff observed. That is what the Superior Court observed. Translating that into impact for the state used to be simple before the PPT, but it got a little more complicated. But it used to be the rule of thumb was for every dollar the TAPS rate is too high, the state loses a quarter in royalty and severance taxes. So if you take 1 million barrels a day and the TAPS rate is a dollar too high, that's $250,000 a day that it costs the state. The TAPS rates right now are between $2 and $3 too high. So you're looking at a substantial amount of money in additional royalty and severance tax if, in fact, the FERC establishes just and reasonable cost-based rates in the same manner and applying the traditional methodologies that the RCA did. If you take a look at page 5, it just shows you some spreadsheets. The TSM, those are their actual numbers under the TSM column. The $60 billion they brought in, the $15 billion, their operating costs or gross plant of 10.4, and their return in tax allowance. And then it shows it compared with two other methods that are commonly used to establish rates. And the bottom line is on line 5, you can see the excessive returns of the TAPS owners compared with any conventional standard. I won't get into the details. They're here, and I'm happy to answer questions, but given the limited time, I don't want to get you through. I don't want to try to go through the actual rate making. But let me just say that the proper state and federal rate is about $2, and under the TSM, there it's about $4, and it just went to $5. In order to try to justify their rates at FERC, the owners did not elect to defend the rate elements in the TSM. Instead, they put on a proxy case that they said represented cost-based rate making. In order to get the rate anywhere close to what the TSM was, what they had to do was go back and where they had already collected deferred earnings and accelerated depreciation, they had to go back historically, even though they'd collected it in rates once. They had to put it back in their rate base and request a return in taxes and request to collect it twice. And that's the basic flaw of their proxy case, is that it would permit double recovery of their actual investment in TAPS. In addition to the transportation rate on TAPS, there's another major issue. And on page 10 of my outline, I go into that, and that's dismantlement, removal, and restoration, or DR&R as we call it. The TAPS carriers collected about $1.5 billion in DR&R from 1977 to date, and it's been largely front-end loaded. If you take a look at what they've collected versus what they've actually, plus what they've actually earned on those collections, their collections and earned about $17.2 billion in 2005 dollars. Their own estimate is that they only need $2.6 billion in 2005 dollars. So we think that they're $14.6 billion over-collected to perform DR&R. One of the fundamental principles of rate making is when you get to pre-collect a cost item from your ratepayers, you're not entitled to a return on the collection of operating costs. And what the TAPS carriers have done with the ratepayers' money in this situation is made over $15 billion of excessive returns. And they refuse to account or acknowledge that it's even refundable or even to account the amount that they've earned on it. I have as my last page, and, you know, and I didn't know how global you wanted to get. I guess from my perspective, an important thing to note is that as you read the FERC staff initial brief, essentially, with regard to just and reasonable rate matters, they asked the judge to adopt the positions of Anadarko and Tesoro. And I think that's important to note. And then finally, on the last page, I just put in, you know, how can you tell when the state's in a bad pipeline deal? Because the TAPS settlement is certainly a bad pipeline deal, and the TSM is a bad pipeline deal. And so I just put together 10 things that I look for and when the state's in a good deal or a bad deal. And I just go through them briefly and conclude. One is that the process isn't transparent or competitive. I think that's important that it be. The second is that rates are not based on the cost of providing service. And essentially, our pipeline transportation corridors should have rates based on the cost of providing service and shouldn't require monopoly profits for the carriers in order to build. The third thing is access. You need fair access. The fourth thing that I look for is whether or not major rate and access issues are resolved. And there's been quite a bit of litigation under the FERC settlement. And FERC's general policies are not well suited for Alaskan issues. The FERC's policies evolved in an environment where there was competition among pipelines, where there were more choices available, and those pipelines are generally owned by third parties and not affiliates. And therefore, they have a series of policies which have developed for situations that are not particularly well suited for the circumstances that we see unique in Alaska. The state of Alaska's inherent powers are restricted. I think it's important that the state maintain its sovereignty and its rights to govern its own affairs. And the TAPS carriers have asked FERC to take over the rate making of the state rate and ask the FERC to set the state rate. It's never been done in 87 years of litigation, but the carriers are asking FERC to take over the RCA's job of setting state rates. There are no protections against self-dealing and affiliated transactions. I think in Alaska, particularly if the deals are done with producers, there are unique affiliated transaction matters that need to be addressed in order to ensure that it's fair for the state and it's fair for third parties and independents trying to also do business here. Linkage to non-transportation matters, that's, I think, self-explanatory. Economic assumptions are unknowable without reopeners. I don't know how many times we have to go through the building economic models on economic factors that are unknowable, such as what the future reserves are going to be. But it's important that a rate that's just and reasonable, that it stay fair for people over the life, that it not be too high, because that restricts development, independent production on the slope, and state royalty and severance taxes, and then not be too low, because that's not fair to the investors in the pipeline infrastructure. And the only way you can kind of ensure that it stays within that zone is to have an opportunity to adjust your models over time as circumstances change and as more information is gathered. Another thing I look for is unnecessary complexity. I don't think these matters are all that complex. And I think when they're made to be, that it's usually an indication that there's something hiding in the complexity that there shouldn't be. And then the last thing I'd say is that I look at whether or not in a pipeline deal, certainty is confused with predictability. And I would note that we had a meeting of all the independents. The state asked for the meeting in order to discuss whether to negotiate a TSM-2 after this TAP settlement methodology expires. And without exception, the independents who gathered said, we can work with a just and reasonable standard. It's a predictable thing for us. We would rather work with the predictability of the just and reasonable standard than to set an artificial rate based on certainty that may be too high for shippers or too low for the carriers. And so please, that's a pretty good indication if certainty is confused with predictability. So that concludes my prepared comments. I've heard a lot of very interesting questions. I'll just address one or two of those, and then I'll be quiet. One is the bits and pieces and fair deal. Nobody is saying you take part of a settlement and apply it going forward. What we're saying is that whatever the investment of recovery profile was that in the past, you recognize it in future rates, because the ratepayers actually paid that amount. So how do you transition from a settlement methodology to a just and reasonable methodology? We think you have to recognize the investment that you've already recovered once, and you don't get a chance to recover it twice. And I'll just stop there. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks. I have one for you. Whenever we deal with costs and revenue, there's another government organization that has a keen interest in that, and of course that's the IRS. Has the IRS ever intervened that you could know of, looking at these books and declaring that the amount of tax paid from the filers was incorrect?
No, the IRS has never intervened in a rate matter that I'm aware of. But with regard to DR&R, the collections of DR&R were assumed by the parties to be non-deductible until the time of use, which means that they wouldn't get current deductions for the removing of the line until actually after the line was removed, when the line was removed. After kind of the deal was struck with the assumption that they needed to also collect a tax allowance, because it was not deductible, the carriers went in and got a private letter ruling that allowed them to deduct $800 million. And that was one of the problems with the DR&R estimates, is that they figured the federal tax rate would be 43, and it shifted to 36, and they figured it would be non-deductible, and then they went in and got it deductible.
Okay, there's another issue, and that's the allowance per barrel. That started out at, I forget, it's up to a dollar something now, but it started out at 70, 35 cents, 70 cents, some number. What's the significance of allocating an allowance per barrel? Is it traceable to a cost or traceable to something that requires that it be there?
First, the allowance per barrel started out to be 35 cents in 1981 dollars and was inflation adjusted until it went into effect in 1981, it was 35 cents, and then it was inflation adjusted until it went into effect in 1990 or 1991. Currently, the allowance per barrel for 2006, if you take a look at the allowance plus the tax allowance portion of it, it's $1.19 a barrel. It is uncontested in the case among the carriers, experts, and ours that the allowance per barrel is not related, is a non-cost element and is not directly related to the cost of providing service. Generally, when you determine return on a pipeline, you take a look at, well, how much money, what's their investment? And if you have $1 billion in it, you're entitled to 15%, then you get $150 million. And that's the way return is calculated in cost-based rate making. It isn't an allowance per barrel that has nothing to do with remaining investment. Essentially, what's happened on TAPS is they got to charge rates up front on a front-end loaded basis that included a very rapid accelerated depreciation, so they got all their investment up front. And then as soon as they got most of their investment recovered, then the allowance per barrel kicked in, giving them a return element unlinked to the remaining investment because their remaining investment was too low. One of the key things to look for in whether or not a rate is cost-based is whether or not the return element is linked to remaining investment or not. The allowance per barrel is not. It is uncontested that it's not cost-based, and it's the primary way in which the carriers are over-collecting a just and reasonable rate today.
I'm going to ask you to make another comment. If a person were to do accelerated cost recovery and essentially recover, let's just say 95% of the cost, and then when they switch to straight line, do they only switch to recover the remaining 5%, or does the straight line backtrack as if straight line had been done since the beginning? Because when I was reading it, I couldn't come up with an answer to how there was a serious advantage in switching from one to the other. But clearly, there was a lot of comments made about doing something just like that.
Well, the very concept of depreciation is that you're allowed to depreciate your actual investment. In the case of TAPS, that was roughly $10 billion. And so through 2006, in rough terms, they collected $9.5 billion of the ten billion that they had invested. So they only had $500 million left, or $500 million. And so that is the basis that you determine the return, because the return is on remaining investment, whatever that investment level is. The carriers have put on a case that has taken their actual investment level from $500 million up to $2.5 billion, and they've sought to recover their investment twice. And so that's the basic flaw in their case. With regard to your comment, if whatever you recovered in the past, you recovered in the past, and you don't get to recover it a second time. So in your example where you go to 95% and then you're at a point where you have 5% remaining, then that 5% remaining should be the basis for the future rates.
And was it in this case?
Well, it is under Anadarko Tesoro's theory of the case. It is not under the carrier's theory of the case. Under the carrier's theory of the case, they went back and took $500 million, and they went back and sought to say that instead of the accelerated depreciation that they said that they were going to recover and that they did include in their filings and that they did charge their ratepayers in over 100 filings, they went to go back and to restate those balances where their supporting schedule showed accelerated depreciation, and that supported the rate. And they went back and tried to restate all those to straight line.
Okay.
That's not the way you do. That's not the way cost base rates are set.
Senator Theriault,
a question on your bullet point here: access to existing and expansion capacity is limited. I mean, right now the TAPS line, of course, has extra capacity. So I'm not sure what you're referring to, or are you referring, making the allegation that with a tariff that is too high economically, access in the bar is set too high?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. That's intended to be a broader question than just TAPS, Senator Theriault. TAPS is a common carrier line, and so theoretically anybody can nominate into it. There are provisions in the tariff that restrict a person's ability to shift from carrier to carrier. There are restrictions in the total capacity by contract where all the carriers have agreed and the state has agreed to what the capacity limits are so that one carrier, that effectively reduced the possibility of competition among the carriers. And there are restrictions in the tariffs on TAPS that restrict how long crude oil may be stored at Valdez so that small producers have to pay large storage fees in order to accumulate sufficient crude oil for transportation out of the state. But setting aside TAPS is one of the more open ones. This point was intended really focused more at the gas line, which would be a contract carriage line than a common carriage line. And the idea is you know you're in a bad deal when the first person there gets to tie up the whole line and control the market that they're serving through their control of the infrastructure of the line.
Typically in the 48 states and maybe the world, do producers own pipelines?
Well, I can't speak so broadly for the world. Producers own pipelines that are necessary to get their oil and gas resources that they're developing to the marketplace. In the lower 48, there are a lot of alternative lines, and generally the lines associated with production are relatively short lines until they make it to the pipeline infrastructure that's more subject to regulation. And generally that pipeline is subject to competitive forces because there's multiple selections of how people can intersect with the kind of pipeline grid in the lower 48. The reality of Alaska is there's one pipeline from these fields, and there will always be one pipeline, whether it's the gas line or whether it's TAPS. It only makes sense for there to be one pipeline. And so the terms for use of that pipeline need to be fair, not only for the producer and their affiliates, who are the first ones there always because infrastructure is developed in response to the initial fines, but also to subsequent independents who bring later fields or marginal fields on also.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You referred to small carriers having to pay high storage fees at Valdez to accumulate enough, and that basically is an impediment to small producers, or not producers at that point, but small explorers to explore and to bring on production. Is that storage part of the TAPS agreement, or is that a separate charge that comes through the Port of Valdez?
That is a term and condition of each of the carriers' individual tariffs, and is not required. And that the TAPS settlement, 85 settlement, does not address. I also don't want to leave the impression, Senator Seaton, that. That is by means the only restriction. When you look at an independent producer's ability to do business in Alaska, the first thing you have to look at is whether or not there's open access to existing facilities within the leases and in the fields, or whether the independent producers are forced to build duplicative facilities where there are existing facilities in place that have capacity to transport. So it's difficult for an independent producer, particularly on a marginal field, to bring it online if field facilities are not open. It's also difficult if the regulated facilities and the transportation rates are too high, because for every dollar the TAPS rate is too high, that's a dollar less per barrel of the value in the ground of their field. So a 300 million barrel crude oil field on the North Slope is worth $300 million less to that producer if the TAPS rate's a dollar high. In this case, they're $2 or $3 high. So that's almost $1 billion in net impact to the economics of an independent producer looking at a 300 million barrel field. And then finally, there is a series of barriers associated with tankage, because as you know, as a seafarer, they're Jones Act tankers, and there's only a few people that come up and provide the transportation service by tanker. So all of those are barriers to independent producers. The TAPS transportation rate and the storage fee is just one example of a system that's really set up to work for integrated major oil, but not necessarily for independents also trying to do business here.
I don't see any other questions from the committee, so I want to tell you how much I appreciate your testimony here. We still have about a half hour to go, and I have only two people left, possibly three. John Iverson and Joyce Lofgren, both from the Alaska Department of Revenue. You're both online. Are you together?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we are. This is John Iverson. I'm here with Joyce Lofgren, and I've actually got John Rush here with me as well.
Okay. John, I've got you up next in the queue. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and affiliation for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Iverson. I'm the tax director of the in the State Department of Revenue.
And you have testimony for us?
I do.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We were asked to put together a scenario regarding with state revenue effects in light of possible FERC rates. And first of all, this is really quite speculative at this point, as I'm sure the committee has gathered. There's a lot that's up in the air here. And it is also, for illustrative purposes only, it's not tied to the state's litigation position. With that said, through 2008, we're really not seeing any change here in terms of state revenue impacts. What we've done in the scenario that we've put together is the possible FERC rate of $2, and we've run that from 2005 to 2008. The reason we picked 2008 is because it's likely that the 2009 rates will not be filed under the TSA, because the state has noticed renegotiation of the TSA and can terminate the agreement as of January 1st of 2009 if a new settlement is not agreed to. So we've used through $2 rates through 2008, We've assumed a refund year of 2010, a state share of 25%, and the refund amount that we've calculated would include interest. For our calculation, we use DOR forecasted barrels. And again, this isn't something that we've even included in our revenue forecast, so this is sort of above and beyond what we've forecasted. And the number that we've came as a, that we've come to as a state share is about $818 million as a refund amount.
John, can you pause a second for a question?
Sure.
We have Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Thank you. I was wondering, have you provided that in writing to the committee? I just haven't found it in my materials.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, no, we have not provided that in writing. In fact, we just have been working on coming up with this today.
Okay, thank you,
okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
And with that in mind, you know, we can tailor this, our assumptions on this, to really anything, any inputs that the state or that the legislators would like us to. So if there's different rates that you would like us to run in this model, that's certainly fine, different forecast barrels, that sort of thing. Other than that, that was really all that we had prepared today to present, but we're certainly willing to answer any questions you might have.
Does Joyce have testimony different from yours or in addition to?
No, I do not have anything different.
Okay, well, hold on then. Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you. John, when you ran that, did you how much did you predict that the production would drop, the 6% that you've heard all along, or was that what you used, or did you use something else?
I would actually like to defer to Joyce for that one. And if you could, our reception kind of got a little garbled there, but I understand it was in regard to a dropping production. But I would like to refer to Joyce on that.
Yes, we use the production forecast provided by Dudley Platt that we'll be issuing in our Spring 07 resources book, and it's about 10% below what it was in the fall. And you can refer either to our online or to the actual publication for the volumes.
Okay.
But it's 10% lower than it was.
Thank you.
In our last forecast.
When you say that, are you talking the volume or are you talking the dollars?
I'm talking the volume.
And have the dollars moved in the same direction as the volume?
No, the volumes have gone down, and our most recent forecasts of oil prices are somewhat higher than they were in the fall.
Senator Terrio?
Thank you. So I want to make sure that I understand the model you put together. It covers 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008?
Actually, through 2007, it's history. It's the Horst historical model, a TSM model that is provided to the state. Then we have developed a model that hooks onto that in 2008 and forecasts out for the long-term forecast.
Okay, so thank you. That's part of what I'm trying to get to is that a lot of the numbers that you've crunched are really historic numbers. You do know what the throughput was. You know what the price was. You know what the tariff charged was. And you recalculated that to say, well, if the tariff component of that was $2 instead of the $4, what would the impact to the value flowing to the Treasury have been?
That's correct.
Okay, and then you've had to, you know, speculate for 2007, 2008, but you know, at least half of the data is historic, and you can get a pretty good read on that. And so it's just going back to earlier statement. It's not calculating or counting on any kind of you know, penalty or anything like that, because the state hasn't asked for any. It would just be the result of Anadarko and Tesoro being successful in their challenge and the tariff being set at using the methodology that they suggest. Is that right?
Well, not exactly. The case that we have run, the tariff is about $2, but that is by a little bit the unwinding of the TSM model. And we're using our forecasting based on that type of a methodology, rate base.
Okay. And what was the total dollar? I didn't write it down when John said.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, $818,132.
And 8 cents.
Or $132,589. And that's assuming a state share of 25% in the year 2010 with interest.
Thank you.
Do you ever run comparisons on the PPT versus the old method and come up with a difference in revenue for any single year, since you haven't had a whole single year yet?
Well, in matter of fact, we've worked through several iterations on it last week, and we're kind of in the throes of analyzing that as we speak.
Okay. And then Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. This is revenue that's online?
Correct.
Are you familiar with the I hope you're familiar with the FERC's staff briefing that we've kind of been going over, and I have a question off of that. And my question is, if you have it in front of you, it's on page 24, bullet number 6. The TSM uses a cost allocation rate design mechanism that allows costs properly allocated to interstate rates, but disallowed by the RCA to be reallocated to interstate rates. I'm wondering if you agree with that, and what impact does that have on state revenues? And the other question is, if there's somebody from FERC, is there authority for them to do that?
Through the chairman, I would actually defer to Phil Reeves on that question.
He's gone. He left. He left. You're stuck with it.
Well, I don't know the answer, so I'm going to have to ask Phil.
Well, we don't either. I do have a question, though. The $818 million, you've heard any number of references to DR&R. Are you familiar with the meaning of it and the significance of it?
In general terms, yes, we are.
That was a nickel a barrel. And the $818 million, is there any DR&R money tucked into that, or is that located somewhere where you could actually find it? Or is it just commingled completely with the revenues from the producers?
Through the chairman, there's no DR&R in that calculation.
Would you be able, if given the task, would you be able to identify the value, actually the proceeds collected, and the current value?
We could certainly look into it.
I'm not real clear. This is Joyce Loughran, and I'm not real clear on the what component you're speaking on.
Are you familiar with the term DR&R?
Yes, I am.
Okay. When they collected their nickel a barrel for forever.
I'm not real clear on that. I mean, it was collected according to the exhibit in the settlement. Is that the exhibit you're referring to?
I can only assume so. I don't have that exhibit. I mean, when you say the exhibit in the settlement, you're talking to a specific page?
That's correct. In the original settlement agreement, where it was a particular amount, dollar value collected year, it wasn't, you know, so I'm not, the nickel a barrel, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well, for tearing down the pipeline when it's no longer useful, cleaning it up,
the DR&R.
Removing, doing all that work. There had to be some money set aside to do that, or else the bill would come due on the last day that we pumped.
That's correct, and that's what it is in that exhibit, that each year how much that amount is that was set aside. I don't have it here, but I could certainly.
Hi, John Rush for the Department of Revenue. To the chair, I think the TSM allowed for about $1.5 billion over the life of the agreement to be collected for DR&R. There's a certain amount each year. It was front-end loaded, as Mr. Brennan said before. Mm-hmm. That's been collected in the rates charged. If you take that and add an interest component to that, as Mr. Brennan said, depending on the interest rate, that could go anywhere from 4 to 6 to maybe $9 billion, depending if you use 8%, 10%, 16% on what you've earned on that money. Mr. Brennan also spoke about a tax deduction that was allowed on that. So there's significant interest effects and tax effects along to the $1.5 billion that has been collected so far.
Well, you have answered the question. I was curious mostly about whether we were just talking about the nickel times the number of nickels collected, or else the time value of all of those nickels brought up to a present day value. And I think that's what you've done. I appreciate that. Are there any other questions? Senator Terrio?
So the calculation you did coming up with the 800 plus million did not anticipate the possibility that FERC may determine DNR R&R to be overcollected and some kind of a reimbursement or adjustment in the rates stemming from that. You didn't factor that in at all.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, that's correct.
Okay, and I understand that. That's very, really speculative, but there's a possibility out there, but who knows what that might be.
And that, too, is correct, and that was our position on that.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. Is there anyone online who I haven't called who had wants an opportunity to testify? Okay, hearing none. Is there anyone in the audience that would like also to testify? I don't see a lot of hands raised. And anyone on the committee that wants to testify? Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to see if we can get from revenue for the committee that the outline of that run that they are making on the tariff and the differential, so that we can actually look at the terms. I was jotting down here, but it was, you know, kind of difficult to get the full handle on it.
Is that okay with you? Anyone in Department of Revenue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we can certainly provide that.
All right. With that, since there is no other testifiers and no other questions, we'll conclude this meeting. And I'm sorry, Senator Terrio has a question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. From the Senate side, we thank you for having the hearing just to get some discussion and information. Certainly over the years, individual legislators have grumbled about TSM, but there wasn't a whole lot that the state could do about it. It wasn't until independent companies took steps to protect their interests that it strengthened the cases, or the state's ability to take action to protect the state's interest. We've had some testimony now that, you know, this is not the beginning of the process, but we're a long way from the end of the process. And perhaps if your committee would commit, or if you would commit through your committee, to kind of keep a watch on this. Because, like I said, other than periodic grumbling, the legislature has not really watched this for a very, very long time. And while we shouldn't gear up to spend a single one of the dollars that's been mentioned here today, because they're very speculative, we should keep an eye on this and just monitor it from time to time as different milestones are reached. In either the FERC process or the challenge into the court process or what have you, because it does have potentially significant impact to the Treasury, and some of the issues that are debated here have impact on the debate that we're undertaking on the next transportation system for resources, potentially.
Okay, thank you. It reminds me, we had a press conference this morning, and the question on this arose. And the gas line arose, and I said the three most important things on the gas line, bar none, are the tariff. And that is exactly what we're talking about here. If indeed we have no control over the tariff, then I'm fearful for the result of getting independent explorers to go out and look for the additional gas, which is absolutely essential that we find in order to make the gas line a economic reality. So we will be looking very carefully at how the tariffs are calculated and what the numbers in the tariffs actually are, so that we can actually look toward a better future for us, because without the gas line, I'm not sure we have a better future. With that, no other question. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, one thing that I did learn here in the meeting today was with the small carriers and the high storage fees. you know, we've been dealing with the contract, and of course, natural gas is somewhat different, but we are going to need people to come forward and bring those different issues to us, because we have been endeavoring through investment credits and many other ways to get exploration going. But if there are other significant blockages to that, we need to know about them, and we need to know about them publicly. So I thank the people that testified today, and thank you for holding the hearing.
I appreciate the audience being here. With that, the meeting is terminated. Thank you for coming.